This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
From the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Place to be nation pop listeners. Welcome to another riveting and rousing and arousing of the titillating. Mm-hmm. Scintillating and tantalizing, longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. Welcome to the L-shaped studios in luxurious Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
That's right, Plaza. They sent us back to Canada.
That's right. We went back to Canada. Like Ken Lashley. and we are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips, and with us this week, after spending a little bit of time in that little old Facebook TV shows, we will do games, we will do all manner of strange things here and there. But this month,
and
we
this
are focusing...
Case, it is not a movie or a game, but it is a steaming pile of horse shit.
Oh my, Nick coming out of the gate swinging, because that's right, folks. We are here to talk about a television show known as Riverdale.
Oh my God.
Now, this show debuted last year on the CW network. And for those who don't know, Riverdale is the city that is the home of Archie Andrews. And this is an adaptation, supposedly, of Archie Comics. Now, Archie is obviously not a superhero property, but if you've ever been to a grocery store, you can't miss the little digest-sized Archie comics that are sitting on the checkout lane at the grocery store. So we figured we are going to be experiencing Riverdale largely for the first time. I did watch the pilot episode when it came on, but I wanted to give it another chance, see if my opinion would change. We wanted to watch two episodes of this one, and actually we were going to watch more, but two was plenty. And
two was too freaking many, in my opinion.
We figured we needed to go outside and get another opinion on this. We needed to spread out our hard traveling wings.
We needed to force someone else to suffer with us, because I wasn't going to do this shit alone.
And so we reached out to our companion and colleague, none other than the host of the Sunday Groove, aka
Easy Like David Sunday.
We reached out to the breastular David Sunday. Mm-hmm. David, welcome once more in a surprise last-minute addition to the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Well, thanks for having me. I was trying to work in the lyrics to tight-fitting jeans, but couldn't pull it up quick enough. So,
well, let's just say after the very unique version of tight-fitting jeans that Todd Weber put on our episode
yeah.
I will never be able to hear that song quite the same way again.
Who was singing on that version? Do we know?
I have no idea. It was just some guy. Like, I think he must
Todd.
Have found. He must have found someone with an ability to sing in a Conway-like tenor.
Well, whoever it was, you know, he's not nearly the accomplished vocalist that star quarterback and all-around solid good guy Archie Andrews is in the steaming pile of horseshit known as Riverdale.
Now, he's not just a musician, he's not just a singer, and he's not just a star athlete. He's also a star poet and songwriter.
Yes. He's literally good at everything.
Except managing his relationships.
How entertaining.
Well, David, thank you for joining us on this somewhat unique edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, to take a look at Riverdale.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I'm glad to suffer with you.
and that's a great way to set the tone and tenor of this conversation, because let's address two elephants in the room right now. Well, primarily one
God's
giant
sake,
elephant.
Here we go.
And then two mini elephants. The big elephant in the room here is that I don't know if you guys were aware of this, but apparently Riverdale, the show in question, is beloved.
And by
who? I'm going to tell you what I'm basing that on.
Who are these people?
If you do a search of Riverdale, you will pull up a 7.6 out of 10 rating on IMDb.
Oh, my God.
You will pull up an 88% Rotten Tomatoes score.
Good Lord.
That's got to be rigged.
This is fucking ridiculous. You will pull out
an 8 out of 10 score from TV.com, and you will pull out a 97% positive from Google users.
And, not to mention, you will also find information on some bullshit MTV award that says that fucking Jughead is hotter than Thor.
That made me angry last night. I'm not going to lie.
Shout out to Tim Capel for providing us with fun facts for the podcast.
Yes. We should all know that no one is hotter than Thor.
No one.
It's just not humanly possible. And if you go to the Wikipedia page and you look at the critical reception,
it's fucking ridiculous.
You will see the critical consensus from Rotten Tomatoes, which reads, "Riverdale offers an amusingly self-aware reimagining."
It's not self-aware! Fuck that shit!
Source material that proves eerie, odd, daring, and above all, addictive. On Metacritic, the season has a score of 68 out of 100 based on 36 critics, indicating generally favorable reviews. Dave Nimitz of TV Line gave the series a B+, saying that it turned, quote, out to be an artfully crafted, instantly engaging teen soap with loads of potential.
Oh, fuck's sake.
You mean pretension?
Oh,
So with this being said, this is a pretty well-loved show. So there's a good chance that if you're listening to us right now and you have watched Riverdale, you probably like Riverdale. So I apologize in advance.
I apologize for nothing.
Because we're about to
shit all over it like it deserves.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. I was going to say we are going to discuss it in a rational and reasonable fashion.
Nope.
But ultimately,
in this scenario, you, the Riverdale fan and listener, you are Ricky Morton, and you are lying underneath the glass table that is Riverdale, and we are the ring rat about to take a giant dump on said glass table.
Yes, and unfortunately, some of it is going to leak onto you and ruin your handsome looks, which resemble that of a pre-accident.
Oh, my God.
What the hell is the guy's name? I've already forgotten.
Nobody knows the fucker's name because no person born after 1970 knows who the fuck Montgomery Clift is. Let alone a 17-year-old.
I'm devastatingly handsome, you know, in that classic pre-accident Montgomery Clift way. Good Lord.
I just don't even.
So Riverdale is...
Fuck it.
Now,
the end.
We talked about the digest format comics of Archie. So before we delve into the show, let's give everyone what our impressions of Archie are, our understanding of Archie. Nick, what do you know about Archie?
Not much.
By the way, are a dyed-in-the-wool anti-Archite.
That's not
true. What are your thoughts on Archie?
Okay. First of all, I know about Archie is it's a red-headed, goofy-looking dude who looks not unlike David Sunday with wavy hair, actually. Who is eternally torn between a blonde and a brunette named Betty and or Veronica. I can't remember which one is which. Then he has his friend who wears a crown for some stupid reason and eats hamburgers all the time named Jughead. Yes, the dude's name is actually Jughead. Outside of that, I have no fucking clue about anything involving Archie other than the fact that there are always comic books at my comic shop. I never see anyone buy them, and yet the next week they've disappeared.
Very good. So we've established out of the gate that Nick is an anti-Archie.
How have we established that? In what way have we established
you
that?
You have denigrated the concept with your sarcastic, demeaning language.
I have literally, Greg, literally never read an Archie comic in my life. After Jennifer and Tim's own hearts.
Oh, I'm just kidding. So Archie, to me, I only know Archie from those little digest comics. And I never have actually read an entire one because they always seemed really, really boring to me. Even as a kid, I never found them funny, and so I would open them and read them. And I'd be like, "Well, that's not very funny," And then the thing would happen. I didn't understand, you know, girls and relationships, which I really only found out about last week, to be honest with you. And so I was like, what in the world is that? I don't get it. So anyway, I moved on. But they're there and certainly are there. David, what about you? Are you familiar with Archie at all?
I mean, I remember seeing him around, but I don't think I ever read any. I probably was intrigued because of a redhead on the cover, just like right. I was with Jimmy Olsen comics. That I got. That I'm the only one that got that excited to find Jimmy Olsen comics.
And that's the thing. Like having never read one, but having had it described to me a couple of times, I've always thought of Archie as being very Jimmy Olsen-esque, like gee golly, and you know, just I don't even know, like a 50s anachronism. I don't even know what I'm trying to say here, but. I feel like this Riverdale thing is not that at
he
all.
He almost looked like, or I guess you could say it's the other way around, that Ron Howard in Happy Days kind of looks a little bit like what you would imagine a real life version of Archie Andrews to look like, right?
God, now I wish that Tom Bosley had been in Riverdale.
I don't know who that is.
Good one.
He played the dad on Happy Days.
Hmm. Riverdale is more like Sad Days, unfortunately. But yes, yeah, so that's kind of what I always imagined Archie to look like in real life, was that kind of deal. And so you get the the kind of, like you said, golly gee, as Tim Capel used to put it, golly gee Hawkum.
Golly gee Rackham is what we need.
That's kind of what you expect from Archie, at least to me. So, David, you're much in the same boat then, as far as you were intrigued by the redheaded lead character, but you never really delved into the books.
Yeah, I guess not, because I don't remember it. If it's golly gee, kind of like that, I might actually enjoy it. But Riverdale is not that. So
it's interesting because like it's this really awkward looking, you know, kind of dorky looking lead character that looks like he's perpetually stuck in the 50s. But he's always got like all of these attractive women like flocking to him, you know. So it's not even really relatable in that way, right? Because like, you know,
I don't know about you, man.
Well, that's true. I don't want to speak for you, David, but certainly in my experience, it's been a rare occurrence. But nonetheless, you have your cast of characters, your Jughead and your whatnot, and that's really the only one I know is I know Jughead, Betty, Veronica, and I've heard of the character Reggie, although I wasn't aware of what his role was. So you take all this, and so we all had kind of the same cursory knowledge of Archie, but I'm also aware, Nick, as you are, through doing the rundown and other things on our show, that there is a subset of Archie comics where they – I don't know how long ago this started, decades ago, I guess, I've been told – that Archie can be used in a lot of different genres. These like alternate universe takes on Archie. So you have like Afterlife with Archie is the probably the most popular one, where it's some kind of zombie based Archie.
Then there's one where it's like they. So you have the again, and I'm not the person to speak from any sort of authority, but like you have the main Archie comics where he perpetually stays like 17 or whatever, and then you have like one where he actually aged and like married. I think they actually have series for both him married to Betty and him married to Veronica. So it's like,
yep.
I don't know.
You've got the serious take with Afterlife with Archie. Mm-hmm. Then you've got like the Mark Waid Archie comics that aren't the digest comics, but actual comics that are like a more like serious, I think, take on the Archie universe.
Oh boy.
And then you've got like, and then over the years you've got weird like one-off crossovers, like Archie meets the Punisher, and
Archie meets Batman 66 is currently on store shelves. Actually, I saw it when I was at the comic.
Well, see,
today.
That makes sense.
That makes a level of sense, right?
Archie meeting the Punisher. I'm not sure, but
now based on the quality of this, if they were going to do a Batman crossover with Riverdale, it would certainly have to be Riverdale meets Gotham.
Yes.
Good Charlotte Penguin would fit in so well.
Good Charlotte Penguin would be a great replacement for Jughead, actually.
Anybody would be a good replacement for Jughead.
I'm sorry, Jughead Jones.
Excuse me. No, not just that. Jughead Jones, the hottest per planet.
The third. So Riverdale, here's Riverdale's take on Archie. Riverdale takes the characters and the setting of Archie and presents it as a teen soap opera drama, not unlike the vein of something like a 90210 or a Melrose,
but we'll
get to that, but put in the context of a murder mystery in a small town.
Oh.
And also put in the context of keeping some of the over-the-top characteristics of the characters, but still trying to be a teen drama while also trying to be a murder mystery. It's very weird, but the basic premise is that one of these red-headed twin characters that I've never heard of before, the Blossom Twins, is dead at the beginning of the series, has been killed. We don't know if he's been murdered.
It's the male one who looks a lot like Robert Pattinson from the Twilight movies.
Yes, and if you've ever seen the scene that we've talked about on the show before from Batman and Harley Quinn with the pig-nosed incestuous twins, it's like that, but if one of them was a girl and they were twins. So this sets up the premise of the show. There's this death, and everybody's reacting to it, and everybody is kind of loosely affiliated with what happened, and nobody really knows what happened or who – responsible for this kid's death, if anyone. So that's where it is when we start, and then you got to lay out the cast of characters, and there's just so much going on. We watched the first two episodes where you do get the murder mystery, but more of the show is built around the interpersonal relationships of the lead character Archie Andrews and his lifelong best friend Betty Cooper.
We're going with
Betty Cooper.
Her name is Betty. That's her name.
Who has been his best friend since childhood and harbors a deep-seated crush for him. And
we're going to go with Betty Vanilla is what we're going to go with.
Wishes that – yes, she even orders an old-fashioned vanilla milkshake to put it across, whereas Veronica orders a double chocolate.
A double fudge, which clearly means she wants a double penetration via the asshole.
My goodness gracious, Nick. You've totally derailed me with that. So Betty is the girl next door, the lifelong best friend, and pines after Archie, who is oblivious to this and just views her as a friend. We're introduced very early on to Veronica Lodge, who is the brunette character you may remember from the comics that Archie is always dealing with. And she comes to town as the rich girl that's trying to redeem herself from a bad past.
And she's going to redeem herself using the power of forced literary references that she's going to drop every 5 to 10 minutes to indicate how much smarter she is than everyone else in town. Because when you're trying to turn over a new leaf and get people to actually like you, lording your bullshit intelligence over them is the best way to do that.
The show is bookended by narration.
Oh God!
Which always works on CW shows. Narration in Rorschach-like fashion from Jughead Jones.
Imagine if 2018 Frank Miller tried to write what he thinks a teenager's interior monologue would sound like, and you essentially have the Jughead monologues from Riverdale. It is. Among the worst, least subtle pieces of derivative bullshit dialogue I've ever seen on a television show.
It's like a whatever you call the post-millennial generation version of like an interpretation of Rod Serling mixed with Rorschach. Imagine, if you will, a small city, dead dog carcasses lining alley.
And there we were at Pop's Chocolate Shop, using the neon light to hold off the darkness for just a few more moments. Shut the fuck up.
Nick, you actually showed emotion in your voice. This dude has to pretend like he's better than it and be apathetic all the time.
Like he's disaffected from everything that's going on.
I guess here's my biggest bitch about this show, if I had to pick just one, and there are many. A few years back when we were still doing the column, back when, you know, we whittled our columns onto slabs of stone.
Yes, when dinosaurs roamed the earth. From our homes.
We briefly had a recurring feature called hashtag Gotham Sucks, where we would sit down and watch a couple episodes of Gotham and tear it apart. And there was a certain amount of joy that could be had in hate watching Gotham. You could find enough things to have it be so bad that you derived at least some form of entertainment from this, from it. With Riverdale, the entire thing is so freaking pretentious and borderline self-serious, there is zero entertainment value in this. The only redeeming quality of this show, there's one. It's got a fuck ton of sex appeal. I'll give you that. Characters are fucking all the time. There's some incestuous redheaded twins to tie into Greg's earlier comment.
There are characters kissing that it doesn't make any sense for them to be doing this.
And not just for their characters. Doesn't make any sense in the context of the scene. Like, there are things going on that are titillating. But you know what? If I wanted to watch titillation with a bullshit, badly acted, badly written story, I'll just watch porn instead. Thanks.
That was pretty good, Nick. That was pretty good. I'm not going to lie. Okay, so you get all these characters in here with the aforementioned everybody. And, you know, there's other characters here. There's Cheryl Blossom, who's the mean girl. She is the sister, the twin of the boy that's killed at the beginning. Name of Jesse Dixon, I think. And
Jason Blossom, I think, was his name.
So how does that relate to Blossom of 90s TV fame?
How does it relate to Rosebuds of Tim Capel fame?
Good question. So you've got all these characters set up here, and there's others as well. There's Mrs. Grundy, the unnaturally attractive young teacher of Archie Andrews, who commits statutory rape by sleeping with him during the summer. Keep in mind, this is Archie freaking Andrews we're talking about, and he is boning his teacher in the first episode, and boning Veronica in the same episode.
Well, he doesn't bone Veronica. They just make out in a closet. Completely different.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought the implication was that they boned, since their clothes were
The game is 7 minutes in heaven, and they spent like...
Oh, that's true. They spent like 5 minutes.
They spent like 5 minutes talking about bullshit that nobody cares about.
I'm not here to judge. Archie may not have lasted long. I don't know. It's not my problem. Anyway, the point is, he's the village bicycle baby. Everybody gets a turn. Wait, what? Anyway, so he's getting around, and I was halfway expecting him to get with Cheryl by the end of the episode, but that hasn't happened yet.
I'm sure it does eventually.
So, Archie friggin' Andrews sleeping with his teacher. Did that bother anybody else? Just me?
I'm sorry. I hate to ask this question. We're not actually watching this for this podcast, are we?
I'm not watching it.
No, maybe I'm not watching it.
Okay. So
maybe I should be, but I'm not.
It should have bothered me, Greg, but I literally started hating the show 20 seconds in. Because I could see, like, the opening shots, if I remember correctly, you get, like, an overhead of the town, and then it cuts to night, and they're, like, filming, like, the trees and stuff, and then they cut to the stupid chocolate shop. And it's there that you get the first glimpse of what the color palette of the show is going to be. And as soon as I saw the color palette, I fucking hated it. Because I'll tell you why. Because it's that thing that shows do sometimes where they want to have, like, darkness and offset it with these bright, bizarre neon colors, kind of like Batman Forever, actually. And as soon as I saw the color palette of that shot, I was instantly like, oh, God, I'm going to hate this. And then we cut to him fucking his teacher in the car, I think, a few minutes later. And I was like, yes, I very much hate this.
Mm. And, you know, I'm not here to, whatever the term is, virtue signal or what have you. But I'm just saying that perhaps the character of Archie Andrews is not the right one to have in a relationship with his teacher, Mrs. Grundy, who, as I understand it, was greatly de-aged for the purpose of this show.
She had to remove the she had the Aunt May anti-dust procedure done.
Yes, and dare I say it, perhaps to a greater degree.
If we're going to talk about redeeming qualities of the show, Mrs. Grundy is quite the looker. I'm not going to deny that. And I can't deny that there's a certain amount of appeal in seeing her pine after this virtually unattractive, much younger person than her. I mean, that you know, we all like to live that fantasy and whatnot, but it doesn't make any fucking sense, and it doesn't make her come off as a good person, and it makes Archie look like a fucking idiot for protecting her the entire time.
So you wind up
being endeared to no one. That's the biggest problem. The show goes through all like these twists and turns and nonsensical character moments, and it exists. These things exist on the premise that you are going to be shocked by these moments because you care about the characters and what the moments mean for each character. But you just don't care about any of the characters because none of them do anything that's rational or likable in the entire two episodes. It is like it is so presumptuous. It thinks because you know it's an Archie show, you're automatically going to care about all these characters. When in reality, fuck them.
Well, here's the thing. I don't agree 100% with what you just said, and I'll get to that in a moment.
But I agree with most of it.
Archie Andrews, who's your main character, is utterly unlikable here. And David, perhaps you'll disagree with that. I don't know. I haven't got
no. I hate him on this show.
By the end of the second episode, who is likable on the show? Name one character.
I would hold up Betty as being fairly likable.
Even after the second episode where she's like, I'm mad at you, Archie. Now I'm not mad at you, Archie. Now I'm not mad at you, Archie. Make up your fucking mind. Like,
well, she's a teenager, and I thought they had her, unlike everyone else in the show, I thought she reacted to the events around her like a natural human being at that age would react.
I don't believe that. I think like it's one of those things that we criticize CW shows for constantly going back and forth on things. Except most of the other CW shows we watch, the superhero shows anyway, they will like when they go back and forth, they will give a couple of episodes in between the flip-flops to let it breathe. But literally, Greg, in the course of like 20 minutes, she changes her mind like four times. By the end of it, I'm like,
right.
Well, fuck her too. Fuck them all.
Well, yeah. But again, I think I agree the transitions are too quick for her character, but I thought that I think that's more to do with the pacing of the show, but I think that her character, the way that she behaved, I think is the way that you react in a situation like that in high school.
I go back and look at
some of my Facebook posts from college, and let's just say I waffled back and forth on things a lot of times. So
let's not encourage that. We don't want to get James gunned off the air, to be honest.
That's a good point. Yeah.
I will grant you, she's the closest thing to a likable character the show has, but she's not that close.
Go ahead, David.
I was going to agree with you, Greg. I mean, it kind of goes with the age. I mean, her being a teenager, I would imagine the emotional flip-flop. And if she had been in love with him for this long, that would hurt, and that would, you know, encourage some awkwardness. I don't know.
So it would encourage some awkwardness that as a teenager, she probably would have been a little bit more like – she probably would have held on to a grudge longer than what is implied to be literally 8 hours before she decides, oh, well, now I'm over it. Oh, wait, I'm not. Like, it all plays out in the course of like 24 hours.
It's also a weird situation because they establish that Betty is – that's her best friend.
And also, to tie into that whole subplot, so the subplot we're talking about is Betty is pissed at Archie because he made out with Veronica, and she's also pissed at Veronica because Veronica shows up in the town, and 8 hours later, she and Betty are inseparable best friends because that makes fucking sense.
Yes,
to the point where when they have their first falling out in the second episode after they've literally known each other for all of 72 hours, Veronica goes on this ultra-serious, long, bullshit monologue to Archie about how Betty was going to be the thing that changed her into a better person, and now she feels like her life is irrevocably damaged by the loss of this relationship she's had for 48 hours!
Yeah, well, here's the other thing about that. So, not only that, but she actually – to give you an idea of the level of pretense that is found in this show, Veronica actually delivers the line at one point to Archie – I just thought Betty and I were destined to be best friends. I thought this is what my whole life had been pointing to. Now, no offense to you guys, either one of you who are two of my oldest and dearest friends, I have never thought of a friendship in those terms. I've never thought to myself, by God, it's friendship at first sight. this has validated my life. It's so bizarre. Like, why would anyone say that? So, yeah, but
no person would say that, Greg. The same way that no person would say anything that anyone says on this show. No people talk like this.
I want to talk more about Archie, though. David, you were mentioning also briefly that you agreed with me that Archie is totally unlikable in this show. Talk a little bit about that of the Archie character here and how you took to him or opposite of that.
Well, I hated him from the get-go. Like, I went into the show wanting to like it because I do like well-done coming-of-age teen things way more than probably a 34-year-old man should. Like, I love Perks of Being a Wallflower. I love a lot of things that picture high school and some stuff like that. So, like, I wanted to like the guy, and he's a redhead. So, I mean, I want to like him. But he is so unlikable early in the show based on decisions and everybody telling him how talented he is and, like, talking like his songs are deep. And, like, all this crap about it. I'm like, this is garbage. How is that deep? How is that a talented song? Like, everything about him I hated within just a few minutes. Like, I wasn't completely hating the show immediately, but I hated him. I knew there was, like, him and Jughead I hated pretty quickly.
He's essentially teenage redheaded Rick, where everyone around him, no matter how stupid and annoying he is, tells him how great he is.
It's
but at least Rick is talented and is a decent guy to begin with. So, man, I don't know.
You know, fuck
it. It's that thing where everything that happens in this universe that they've created revolves around this character. Mm-hmm. Everything.
Which is fine. Like,
his teacher's in love with him.
Which, to that point, Greg, that's okay. Because, like, I think sometimes we criticize these CW shows for getting away from the lead character. Like, we criticize The Flash for not being more about Barry Allen, or we criticize Arrow for not being more about Oliver. I don't have a problem with most of the things in the universe revolving around him. The issue is there has to be something to the character at the center that makes you care about the universe revolving around him. But when there's a black hole of suck at the center of that universe,
and it's hard to care about a character when everyone is telling you should care about him. Show us, don't tell us. Okay. So his teacher's in love with him, or at least in lust with him.
I'm about to say, she's not in love with him.
His two gorgeous girls are in love with him, essentially. Veronica's getting there. We all know that. His dad wants him to work with him because he's such a good and hard worker. He's the best player on the football team. He is a star. We're told that he is a great and deep musician. He is a good-hearted person, you know, because his dad tells us in the second episode, or because Jughead tells us in the second episode that Archie has always tried to do the right thing, and so you end up with a show. At times, Riverdale reminded me in terms of it. Not bear with me here because I'm not comparing the quality of the shows because I really, really love this other show I'm going to talk about. But Riverdale reminded me in its bare bones of Smallville, but Smallville. Taken to extremes, like the quote CW aspect end quote of Smallville, where, you know, Clark's relationship with his dad, his drama with Lana, the Chloe relationship where she's his best friend but she's in love with him but he doesn't love her back. Now that I'm thinking about it, as I'm laying this out, it's actually a lot more similar than I thought originally. You know, the only thing you're missing is the Lionel Luther figure, but I guess that could be Betty's mom almost in this situation. So it's got these bare bone figures, but it's taking away the heart from all of that, because the thing that always made Smallville work was at the center of the show was heart. Clark Kent was a character with heart. Archie isn't a character with heart. He's a character with abs.
Yes. That's his that's his biggest, most defining character trait, is that he has abs.
Yeah, and so you have all of these people telling you how great Archie is and how wonderful Archie is and how if only Archie would love me back, you know. But yet, even despite all this, he's also got a bad boy side to him, as Veronica tells us. She literally says, "Oh, you're darker than I thought," and it's just it's maddening. It's John maddening to listen to, and. You know, so that's your first problem out of the gate, is your lead character is a total dud. Like, he's not likable, not good, not funny, not engaging in any way. I didn't think so anyway. I didn't think he was. I mean, I'm not knocking the actor too much because I really don't think that he's a bad actor per se. I just don't think that he was particularly engaging. Any disagreement there?
Who are we talking about?
Archie actor.
No,
name of
no
name
one.
Of,
No yes, actor in this show is good. Not one.
Oh, no, I wouldn't go that far, Nick.
Oh, for God's sake.
Because we're going to get to one actor in particular that is good. But then there's I will say this is – okay, we want to get a little – for the purposes of this committee, a little bit of a hot take. I'll go so far as to say I think Betty is a good actor. I think I'm looking at the – let me look at the cast and tell you who I think was good and who I think sucked. Well, that would be assuming that the Wikipedia page actually had a cast section for this. There it is. KJ Apa as Archibald – Archie Andrews. Whew. No, I'm not going to give him that. Lily Reinhart as Elizabeth Betty Cooper. Yes, I thought she was good, actually. She shows a range of emotions. I thought she did fine. Camila Mendez as Veronica Lodge.
No, awful.
You know, whatever.
The worst.
Cole Sprouse as – are you ready for this? Are you ready for his full name, guys?
No.
God almighty. Forsyth Jughead Jones III. No. Marisol Nichols as Hermione Lodge, Veronica's mother. No. I think she goes way over the top with it, which would be fine in a better version of this show that is a comedy. Madeline Petch as Cheryl Blossom, she's fine. Ashley Murray as Josephine Josie McCoy, she's not really a character, from what we've seen anyway. And then there's other characters here that we haven't been introduced to yet, including Hiram Lodge, Veronica's father.
That's an amazing name.
It really is. But yeah, oh, and of course, I would be remiss in not mentioning 90210 alum and 8 Seconds alum, Luke Perry as Frederick Fred Andrews, Archie's father, who owns a construction company. And there is something that I want to get to a little bit later because I'm not done shitting on everything yet. So, David, when you hear that list of characters, what are you on Nick's side or are you on my side? Do you think there were some good performances in there or is it largely shite?
I mean, I hate Archie. There's no doubt about that. Him and Jughead, there's nothing redeeming about their acting or anything on the show. I like Betty. I don't think she's amazing, but I think she does a better job than most of them. And I'm looking through, other than one I know you're wanting to go back to later, yeah, I really can't say much about the rest of them as, you know, anything positive.
I understand that.
One thing that irritated me is the stereotypical gay friend. I know we haven't gotten there yet, but
yeah.
It just seems like they really go too over the top with him.
What is his character's name? I'm trying to find it.
Kevin, I just scrolled past him. Kevin Keller. They pretty much make him a 90s caricature.
I swear I thought he was her brother, but he's not. He's just a friend, I guess.
Yeah.
Always around her. But yeah, I think at one point they even call him out. Like one of the other characters calls him out as being a stereotype. Or a cliche anyway, or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It was, which is one of the few moments of self-awareness on here. And so, yeah, I agree. He was not a very good actor, I thought. And I hate
his performance, but sorry, we're focusing on
his performance is awful, and they give him some of the worst lines of any of the characters.
Other than Veronica, he probably has the worst lines.
Yes, he and Veronica have the – because he's the one that delivers that immortal Montgomery.
Old fucking 50s actor line, whatever the fuck his name
which,
was.
That's the thing. Okay, we got to steer away from the acting because the acting we've established is largely crap. I have a little bit more time for it than you guys. But okay, so let's get to the what – we've talked about this with Gotham.
Yep.
And it's the same thing here. What era is this taking place in?
They don't they think that if they don't define the time period specifically, that it makes it more faithful, where it's being faithful to the roots of the comics by also being a modern retelling, when in actuality, it just makes it unintelligible bullshit.
Yeah, because the clothing for the most part, and the cars and the technology are all modern, and the music and things of that nature. But the verbiage and the dialogue is like out of literally like taken out of the 1950s or 60s. Every single pop culture reference, with the exception of like one or two in this show, such as what was the one of those ginger lines that they make about
Justin
about Archie?
Gingerlake.
Justin Gingerlake. That's one of like two contemporary references in the show. Every other reference from any character is to some obscure 1940s or 50s or 60s movie or TV show or book. It is so bizarre. I wasn't the only one to notice that. You mentioned it too, Nick, but it's just such a – people don't talk like that, but especially 17-year-old kids in 2018 aren't referencing, you know, Clark Gable and, you know, whoever the hell else.
Hey. Well, yeah, I'm sure they haven't read those – you know, watch the old movies, and I'm sure they haven't read old books. So, like, the thought of them, you know, reference to them is ridiculous.
For instance, Veronica walks into the, as Nick puts it, damn chocolate shop, and walks in, and her, I believe maybe her first line is, yes. Or one of her first lines is, I'm breakfast at Tiffany's, and this place is more in cold blood. Are you a big Capote fan? Oh my God, that was when I first watched the pop pilot last year. That was the line, the singular line, that made me Seinfeld GIF. Throw up my hands and just say that this is not going to be for me. Just a pile of pretentious bullshit, in my opinion. David, what about you? Are you a big fan of references to old things from teenagers? We reference old things. We reference old music. But my gosh, there's a limit to what's and believable.
And music is a lot more believable than the classic movies. I don't know any young person that watches classic movies. I don't watch classic movies. Not that classic, anyway. So I find that more ludicrous than the music thing.
Well, and the idea that not only are they watching classic movies or reading classic books, because, okay, there are people out there that do that, I guess, but not that everyone would get the reference, as they clearly do in this group, because everyone laughs. Every time someone makes one of these references, everyone in the group laughs. So they all get it, clearly. So, like, but then also, they don't just know the movies and the books. They know the personal lives of the stars and the authors from back then, because this guy, Montgomery Clift, the accident that this kid's referring to, I had to Wikipedia this. This guy was in a car accident that disfigured his face and had to be reconstructed, and thus he was never the same again in Hollywood.
Or how about fucking Veronica referencing Our Town, a 1940 film based on a 1938 play by Thornton fucking Wilder? Nobody gives a shit.
Thornton. Now there's a name that needs to come back. How come you don't hear any Thorntons anymore?
All I'm saying is this show is horseshit.
So, David, what's your take on the whole, time displacement aspect of Riverdale?
I'll be honest, I didn't pay much attention to it. maybe I noticed it last year.
That's the smartest thing anyone said on this show to this point.
Well, I mean, maybe last year I paid more attention because I stupidly watched, I think, 4 or 5 episodes last year.
Good Lord, why?
I'm going to get there because of all those, you know, CW commercials, Dare to Defy, and they would, like, have all the hot scenes from the show. And, like, so I kept thinking, oh, it's going to be the next episode. It'll be episode 3. Well, it wasn't. It'll be episode 4. And then when I finally got there and it, you know, really wasn't that great of a scene, and I was like, why am I being sucked into this?
David is saying essentially that Riverdale has given its viewing audience a case of blue balls.
That's not exactly what I'm saying, but I mean, you know, the commercials, you know how those CW commercials are. They're, you know, the same thing over and over again, and they intrigue you a little bit, but
except Dynasty. I've never been intrigued by Dynasty commercials.
Well, I mean, I didn't watch it, but
I didn't know that.
No, Lord. I said I didn't. I didn't watch
it. Oh, dang it.
I almost did, but I wasn't going to do have the Riverdale syndrome again. But anyway, I watched 4 or 5 episodes last year, hated it. This time around, I was watching it, but I wasn't paying nearly as close of attention as y'all were to the dialogue, at least, and definitely didn't give a thought about the time frame or the time period.
And certainly not Thornton Wilder. So the unlikable characters. Veronica's not likable at all. Jughead is not likable.
No one on the show is likable.
Unlikable characters. So, David, since you're the host of a music podcast,
oh my god,
I think it's appropriate for us to now move on and discuss the music of this show. And the music of this show primarily comes from two sets of the recurring characters. You, of course, get the singer-songwriter stylings of Archie Andrews. You get the more pop, punk, R&B-infused vibes of Josie and the Pussycats, who take their pussycatness very seriously, according to their brief exchange with Archie in the first episode. So, David, as a host of a music podcast, how would you classify the musical stylings of Mr. Andrew and Andrews rather, and the aforementioned Pussycats, along with their leader Josie?
Well, the music is absolute horseshit, and Archie can't sing worth anything, in my opinion. I think Josie does have a good voice, but I absolutely hate every performance. Like, I think there might be some talent hidden underneath there, but it really leaves a lot to be desired.
And the other thing about Josie and the Pussycats that I noticed in the first episode, it's established that almost all of their material before the show starts has been original material. They tell us that. They're known for writing their own songs. But in the first episode, they do a cover of a song that I've never heard of. And in the second episode, they do what sounds like an original song, but the chorus is a direct cover of a 60s song, again, that I've forgotten the name of. But it's one of those, like, you know, songs that would be popular in 1966 or something, you know, and very poppy and all that stuff. So they're apparently not that original, in fact.
Right. I actually like the song they were covering. Right. And it got stuck in my head, unfortunately.
Of course, yes, yes. But, you know, and yeah, I do agree with you. She's got a good voice. She does have a good voice. But yes, not exactly a masterpiece of musicianship on the series at this point. And it makes me wonder how that even works. I found myself thinking about that as I was listening to Josie and the Pussycats play the opening football game in the end of the second episode.
Yeah.
I was thinking to myself, now, are these actors – like assembling this band and playing the song themselves and singing it, or is there some outside band that the producers of the show pay to make the song and then Josie and the Pussycats pretend to play it, or is there an existing song that we're hearing that is by some other band and they're purporting it on the show to be by Josie and the Pussycats? I had all kinds of questions about this. Now, listening audience, you could say, Greg, couldn't you have just Googled this information? The answer to that is yes. And I would respond that to you. I respond to you with that. And I would also respond to you with another question. Do you think I give a single shit about this show enough to Google it? The answer to that is also yes. No, I'm kidding. It's no. I don't care. But nonetheless, if any of you out there do know how the music on this show works, tweet at JR's BBQ and let us know exactly who makes the music for Josie and the Pussycats on Riverdale.
That Archie, he's got high cheekbones. He looks not unlike Maureen O'Hara.
Maureen O'Hara. You know, I've ever talked to you. That Archie's got red hair. You know who else had red hair? Maureen O'Hara. Now, I'm not trying to come on to Archie now. I'm not trying to flirt with him. I'm just saying, he's got qualities that are like my childhood crush, Maureen O'Hara.
Well, JR had Happy.
Well, so away from that, let's get on to what I do want to talk about here. A good thing that I thought in the episode.
Oh,
if
God.
I was to establish
– here we go.
If I were to point out a good scene in this entire first two episodes –
no.
It would be one of two, and probably this one in particular. In the pilot episode, a scene between Archie Andrews and his father, played by Luke Perry. Mm-hmm. Now, Luke Perry, people may remember from 90210. People may remember from 8 Seconds. I know we've got a lot of 8 Seconds fans out there in the audience. People may remember from the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie.
Oh, he was in that, yeah.
Yes, alongside, was Elizabeth Shue? No,
Christy Swanson.
Christy Swanson. Close enough. Swansonite. I was way off. You know, he's been in some stuff, you know, some things and stuff. And I've always been a fan of Luke Perry since I was a kid watching 90210. And so I was happy to see him pop up here, but I was not expecting him to fall so nicely and comfortably into the role of the wise, you know, mentor father figure. You know, basically the Jonathan Kent of this show, let's face it. Much in the same way that I thought that John Schneider was able to reinvent himself from the Dukes of Hazzard onto Smallville in this father role, I thought Luke Perry actually did a really good job of adding a little bit of heart to a show that is so lacking in it, in my opinion. And I may be on an island with this, but I thought the scene with Archie and his dad in the first episode, when his dad finds out that Archie doesn't want to work with him like he thought he did, mm-hmm. I thought it was really good and really emotional. And maybe it's partly because of you know, just my own proclivity for father-son stories and the idea that there's actually a character in a fictional series that does manual labor for a living and doesn't work in an office. I thought that was kind of cool. But I really liked that scene, and I thought Luke Perry really gave good performances in both these first two episodes.
No, I agree. He was good. I liked that one. I actually liked the scene in the second episode a little better.
Yeah, that was good too.
Where
the scene in the second episode is just like generic, like – made for TV after school television special father son advice.
No,
sometimes you got to do the right thing, even when it's hard.
You built it as that.
Shut the fuck up.
You built it as that, and it wasn't that. It was actually very similar to some talks I had with my dad growing up. So
you know what would be better? You know what would have made those scenes better? If it had been James Vanderbeek and they would have had Texas accents, and because the first scene was essentially the damn Varsity Blues scene, and Archie had said, "I don't want your lie." That was the scene. That was essentially the same fucking thing. Fuck it. Fuck it all.
No, but there's a huge difference because James Vanderbeek's dad was a dick. No, let me rephrase. I don't know James Vanderbeek's dad. He's probably a great guy. The character of Chance, Moxie. What was his name, Nick?
I don't fucking know.
Chance, John, whatever.
What movie you have to know?
Whatever his character's name was in that movie, Mox, I think was his name. His dad was Dick. Luke Perry is not a dick in this show. Luke Perry is a good dad who's trying to, who he's emotionally wrapped up in his son, and he's upset that his son's no longer their relationship seems to be going by the wayside, in his opinion, because of Archie dealing with things and stuff.
Because of Archie being a douche.
Yes, being a douche. So I really liked those father-son scenes. But anyway, David, get back to what you were saying.
I was just going to say, I mean, he did a good job in those scenes. Like, whether it was generic or not, like, he did a good job delivering it. And I couldn't help think, and this is not just me flattering Greg, like, I could not help but think, like, this guy deserves a better show. Because he's actually given a good performance.
Yes. I would love to see a career resurgence for Luke Perry. Get him on something that doesn't suck to this degree. But then again, it's very popular. People love it and all that crap. But you know, whatever. Not for me.
People also like The Big Bang Theory.
People do. And speaking of banging, there's lots of banging in this show. Mm-hmm. As we've established early on, Grundy bangs Archie. Veronica and Archie make out. It looks for a brief moment as if Veronica and Betty are going to bang, but they don't. Then it looks like Cheryl and Betty are going to bang, and they don't. I don't think Jughead bangs anyone yet. Oh, the kid Kevin, he bangs Moose in the forest or whatever. Then there's who else is there? There's got to be others that I'm leaving out here. Maybe not. Do you know who was weird in this show is the principal.
That's one thing I was going to call out. Did you guys notice how there's no black characters in the show except for authority figures?
That's yes, right. I noticed that tonight.
There's no black teens at this university.
The mayor is black. The principal is black. The owner of the chocolate shop is black. And it just like – those are the only black characters they have are these token authority figures. It makes no sense. Oh, and Josie.
Josie's
just there to sing. She's not actually a character in these first two episodes.
Right. And not just no black characters, but no minority characters at all.
I mean, no gay Cranchy. Character, I guess, would be would qualify.
Well, true, yeah, but I'm talking about, like, yeah, that's a good point. But in terms of other ethnicities.
Wasn't Reggie Asian?
Yeah, Reggie is.
Is he?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, okay, regardless. It's not a lot is what I'm getting at. It's one of the whitest shows you'll ever see. But in the modern era, anyway. Yeah, so there's just it's very strange. A very strange show. God, what else is there to even say about this thing?
You mentioned, or you didn't mention, two of the best names. The butler, or whatever the heck his name, you know.
Oh, Smithers.
And then there was also a Dilton Doyle. I don't have a clue who it was, but I wrote that
That's
name.
That's right, at the very beginning. God. At the very beginning, he's the leader of the Boy Scout troop that finds the body of the kid washed up, or not the body, but sees what's-her-name sitting out there all alone on her own, and the redheaded girl, Cheryl Blossom, yeah, and his name is Dilton Doyle.
It makes me think of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, so, you know, that's something.
Oh, my gosh. Now, that would be a better show. Whatever you call it, the city that they're in primarily at Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Oh, you can clearly call it Mississippi.
Mississippi. and that would be a much better show. I would watch that in a heartbeat. It would do probably a rating of 0.002, but I would be part of that 0.002.
Yes, I don't know. The Coen Brothers stuff is pretty popular, so it might
that's
have.
That's true. And at least we'd know what time period it takes place in.
Yes.
The era of Papillon Daniel.
Governor.
Anyway, so trying to figure out what else there is to say about all this.
What would Carl Childers say about it?
About what? About what?
Just anything regarding the show.
About anything. All right, hang on. Let me see here. You might say something along the lines of, God, I don't know if I can even get this out. Holy. All right. I don't know if Carl can even get this out. Old man Jones had a boy. Name of Forsyth J. Jones III. He used to make quite a bit of sport of me. Quite a bit of sport indeed.
Now, if Mr. Childers, if the character Kevin Keller were going to use a certain object in his personal life, how would you describe that object?
Kindly shaped like a banana.
And what would if you were going to say it resembled something besides a banana, what would it resemble?
Some folks calls it a.
Damn it, Craig!
I don't rightly know what you mean.
I mean, if it were
Halo
a
stop.
There we go. God, it took. It's like pulling teeth tonight. Come on.
Got one of them flying peckers. Fixed him up a little stop on it. That Hermione Lodge. That Jughead used to make sport of her too. Hit him upside the head with a sling blade. Some folks call it a Kaiser blade. In this case, I'll call it a sling blade. Killed him.
The show fucking sucks.
Yeah, I don't know what else to say at this point.
Yeah, I mean,
we pretty well plowed over the ground of this show. We came not to praise it, but to bury it.
Mm-hmm.
And but I will say,
oh God,
more things that suck about the show. The transitions are very sudden at times. Yep. On here.
It is not well made in any regard. In any single regard.
The cinematography is fine, I think. I think some of the shots are kind of cool. It looks modern and fresh, but yeah, it's very the direction, the I mean, it's bad. Like, there's no like, it's like it's one. It's the kind of bad too that like
isn't entertaining.
Really get a lot of,
mm-hmm.
You know, like it's not good bad.
It's
just
bad. A big fucking waste of time.
Boy, yeah.
What bugs me about it, even more than just the bad acting and stuff, was how they try to add in the, you know, mystery aspect and a little bit of intrigue and stuff like that, but it's really not intriguing. Like, they don't do a good job building to any of the reveals.
Well, yeah, because they have you – they kill off this character in the opening 5 minutes that you haven't been given any fucking reason to care about. And the only way they try to make you care is by showing the emotional trauma of the most unlikable character on the show, the villain of the fucking first two episodes. So if you're supposed to hate the person who is most emotionally affected and you didn't know the person who was actually killed, why do you give a shit? And the answer is you don't. And if you do, you were objectively wrong.
Oh, now with all that being said, the show sucks. It's terrible. It's the worst.
Yes.
And I do want to know who killed that kid.
Oh, my God, Greg.
So what I'm going to do is, once we get done tonight, I'm going to go on Wikipedia. I'm going to read the episode summaries, and I'm going to read to the last sentence of the episode summary, which is all that matters because nothing of note happens until the last 5 minutes of the episode. When they do the, like, you know, whatever. That's the only time they really address the murder mystery is in the last minute to 5 minutes of the episode, right?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to. I just couldn't figure out how to word it.
Because, like, even at the end of the second episode, they do that scene where Cheryl Blossom breaks down crying and she goes into the locker room and Veronica goes in to console her, even though they're arch nemeses. And it's supposed to be a moment of Veronica showing maturity. And so she sits down next to Cheryl, and Cheryl says, he's gone. He was supposed to come back, but now he's gone. And it's kind of as like a throwaway thing. They don't follow up on it, but it's clearly supposed to make you say, oh, revealing more about the mystery. But anyway, I will admit, I do want to know who killed the kid. But I'll just read through the Wikipedia summaries and figure it out, because I ain't nobody got time for this.
I want to see them kill the kid. He just
actually that wouldn't be bad either.
Yeah, he's kind of got a douche face.
He does, especially once he's dead and bloated. and they actually refer to his dead and bloated corpse, and as he's being examined. But yeah, and the other thing, okay, I did not, and I know they probably explain it later on, but I'm sorry. You need to figure out if you're trying to be a serious murder mystery drama. If you're trying to be a weird, like, satire, if you're trying to be an over-the-top soap opera, if you're trying to be – which I think that's the closest thing that it's trying to be is a soap opera. But then you need to figure out, you know, you can't keep straddling the fence between this serious melodrama with Archie and his and Betty and then this over-the-top absolute caricature of an individual that is Betty's mom that is not like any person that's ever lived. And just a complete caricature. And then there's who else is there in the show that's like a caricature? I don't think – help me out here, guys. The characters that just seem like they
– All of them?
A lot of them. Moose, for sure, is a caricature. And then there's like Reggie, of course, is a caricature, not really a fully fledged out character, which he's only in the show for a few minutes anyway. But, it just – you can't have that – they'll try to have this serious emotional scene 1 minute, and then the next scene they've got characters spouting – babbling off dialogue that absolutely makes no sense. And in the span of like a superhero show, you can – I can suspend my disbelief because it's not about, you know, the – it's about this over-the-top concept to begin with. Riverdale's trying to, at its heart, be a murder mystery. And when I think murder mystery, I think something like True Detective or something like The Killing or something like what was that? What was that movie with just pretty much any David Fincher movie, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't think of teenagers talking about Thornton Wilder books or whatever the hell. So anyway, lowest recommendation from me. Would not watch again. For those of you that like it, glad you do. Absolutely. We hope you continue listening to us. But no, I'm not a fan of this at all. Gentlemen, David, what about you?
Oh, it's garbage. I have no use for it.
Nick?
Oh, it wasn't that bad.
Actually, not that bad.
Fuck it. It is like... There's nothing redeeming about it. It's not entertaining in any kind of way. There is nothing good to be derived from having watched it. It's the equivalent of the bullshit essay answer that Billy Madison gives at the end of Billy Madison. I award Riverdale no points, and may God have mercy on the souls of all people who were involved in the making of it. If you like it, I'm sorry you have bad taste in things, and that's probably not a good indicator that you're listening to our podcast. So, yeah, not a good situation all around.
I will just sum up my thoughts on it with two words that come to mind. Televised dysentery. And with that being said, we wrap this portion of the show up. You can catch us on social media. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. If you're going to yell at us for our Riverdale hate, please tweet us at jrsbbq. You can also send us an email at the loneliest email addresses on the internet, gregp@playtospenation.com and nickd@playtospenation.com. Please join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Over on Facebook, just go into your search bar, type in Place to Be Nation Comics. You'll find us there. And you can tweet us at PTBN Comics. At this point, the loneliest Twitter address on the internet. David, how can people find you on social media, and what do you have coming our way on the pop feed?
Okay, well, I run Sunday Groove. You can find me at Sunday Groove PTB on Twitter, or David Sunday on Facebook. Andy, Helene, and myself from Survey Says just did a really fun episode of my 1 year mark, 12th episode of Sunday Groove, where we talk about our favorite concert experiences. So that was a lot of fun. That should be coming out within a week. We recorded it already, but I don't know how much is in the queue before us. But it'll be before you very soon.
Very, very good. Interested to hear that. I wonder if any concerts that I was in attendance for made your list.
You'll have to tune in to find out.
Ah, the tease that is David Sunday. Well, with that being said, folks, we are going to take a commercial break here. When we come back, we'll have reading, we'll have watching, and of course, we'll have the rundown right here on the HTF.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead.
As well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans.
With the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hi there. Have you recently gone through a crisis? Did you find out your friends had been lying to you for years to cover up something they did? Have you discovered that one of your bitter enemies might actually be three people? Were you seemingly killed by a new god only to find yourself quantum leaping through time until you make it back to the present? Was your entire reality wiped out in a cosmic battle between two godlike beings only to be reborn, destroyed, and reborn again? Then join me, Russell Sellers, and my special guests as we help you manage your post-crisis life in DC Post-Crisis Management, a limited monthly series starting in September. We can't promise you closure, but we will try to avoid destroying your hometown and turning you into a homicidal maniac who wipes out time.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the hard-traveling fanboys off the page. Well, actually, our off-the-page portion is done now. We want to thank David Sunday again for joining us. Catch him on Sunday Groove PTB on Twitter, and look out for the Sunday Groove podcast. But now it's time for us to get on to our weekly segment where we talk about what we have been reading and what we have been watching. It's a segment named by the people for the people, a segment we call Reading and Watching. Nick, I am steady at work on our next long book, so I haven't been reading anything other than that. What about you?
Yeah, I haven't read anything either, but I did watch something.
Oh!
I completed, I was able to finish up season 2 of Jessica Jones, and I will say it was outstanding. It was not to the level of season 1, obviously. I don't want to give away too many plot points, but, you know, because you're going to watch it at some point. I loved it, and Trish Walker is now objectively the worst person in the Marvel Netflix universe. I got no time for some Trish
the
Walker.
The worst person.
The worst person.
Worse than Kingpin.
Yes, to me, the worst fucking person.
Who has killed people by stomping their heads in, innocent people, and murdered the innocent journalist Ben Urich.
I'm going to withhold comment.
Okay, fair enough. Worse than crying Karen Page.
Oh, if you even, like, if you can watch Jessica Jones season 2, Greg, and try to argue with a straight face that that Karen Page is worse than Trish Walker, then there's no discussion we can have. There is no common ground. Trish is the fucking worst. And you'll learn that if you ever get around to watching the show.
Which I won't for some time because I have to, according to you, I have to watch Iron Fist.
What?
I have to watch Defenders.
Why not watch Iron Fist
then?
Watch Iron Fist.
There's other shit I have to watch.
Like what?
Krypton. I'd rather finish Krypton before watching any of those.
I got an idea. We should do an off the page on Iron Fist to help you, to help spur you along in your journey.
I don't want to watch Iron Fist.
No,
I don't
want
to watch.
That's
it.
Not what you said. That's not what you said. You were very excited about it.
That's not what I said when it was in development. Okay, do you want to go back and watch all the seasons of Gotham? Let's do that then. Let's make a trade off, Nick. I will watch the entirety of Iron Fist.
Yeah, but there's nothing. The difference is there is no canonically related show to Gotham that I actually want to watch.
Oh, I don't care about that. I don't give a god dang about that. I can read on Wikipedia what happened in Iron Fist that I need to know for the other shows, which, by the way, will be nothing for The Punisher, which is the one Marvel show I really want to watch right now. But you won't let me, because you won't let me skip Iron Fist and Defenders.
Greg, you act like I actually have any influence over what you as a grown-ass man do with your fucking time.
You do. You do. You put peer pressure on me. And as you know, Nick...
And as you told me over the years, that never works, so why are you listening to it?
You're throwing in shoot aspects here. Shoot aspects to our characters. The character of Hulk Hogan is not the same as Terry Bollea. Two different characters.
Why did the Hogan character not take legal action, Greg?
That's a great question. Nick, he was run over with a Hummer. Now, to me, his character should take legal action and file formal charges.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that just makes sense.
It just makes sense, and you're no person to be talking
about
logic.
I'm nobody to talk about logic.
Right.
We just lost our entire listening audience other than Tim.
Other than Tim, yeah, that's a good point.
Anyway, but what listening audience do we have other than Tim? So, you know, what do we got? So, yeah, well, very good, Nick. I'm glad to hear you enjoy Jessica Jones. I do want to see it. I loved season one, as you know. It's my favorite Marvel show so far by a landslide of the Netflix shows. And very, very much looking forward to that one. But again, I got a lot to get through in order to get there. I also still want to watch Cloak and Dagger, by the way, which I really enjoyed the first two episodes of. Mm-hmm. All kinds of stuff here, Nick. I haven't watched Runaways. I haven't watched Legion season two. I haven't watched any of The Gifted. Or The Grifted, which of course is a show from DC about a young grifter from the Wildstorm universe. There's all kinds of things that I haven't watched. But I haven't watched anything this past week anyway, and I was going to start on Arkham Knight, but stop me if you've heard this before, Nick. I didn't. So
yes, that happened for about a solid 3-month period there when you had a PS4 before you had a PS4.
Well, I was also commuting 2 hours every day. So it was a little harder for me to play video games at that time. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I will say something. And what that thing is that I'm going to say is that now that I am finally all caught up on the G1 Climax tournament that we'll talk about later on in the show, I should have more time to delve into video games a little bit here. So, and admittedly, I've been spending a lot of time playing WWE 2K18 and modifying my universe rosters for my WCW Saturday Night Show.
Mm.
But all that notwithstanding, read and watch is kind of a flop this week, Nick. I just realized.
So let's move on.
Watching ever. Let's move on to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. Let's move on to The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to The Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
And here to kick things off, we've got a murder mystery worthy of Riverdale. Because DC Comics has announced via an image that they have released on the cover of DC Nation, one of these six characters will die. Likely in Tom King Clayman's Heroes in Crisis #1, which comes out September 26th. And the characters, let's talk about the characters on the cover of this magazine, and it says one of these are going to die. So you've got Arsenal, a.k.a. Possible. Roy Harper. You've got Booster Gold.
Possible.
You've got Harley Quinn.
Will not happen. No, I don't believe that for a second.
You've got Tim Drake, Red Robin.
Won't happen.
You've got Kyle Rayner.
Oh, please, dear, sweet Leonard. Lord, baby Jesus, let it happen.
And you've got Cyborg.
Won't happen.
Yes, so you've given your take on these. Let me go through one by one and give mine. Roy Harper, absolutely on the board. Mm-hmm. I would pencil him in as my number two most likely to die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good way to go about this. Let's rank them.
Oh, okay.
Let's rank them from most to least likely to die.
Okay.
Or at least most. Which one would you prefer?
It doesn't matter. However you want to do it.
Let's go most to least.
Most to least. Actually, let's go least to most.
Least to most. All right. Least for me is Harley Quinn.
I would agree. Harley Quinn, yeah.
Second least, Cyborg.
Yes.
Too valuable to the line, too popular in Teen Titans Go. They would be foolish to take him off the board.
Right, and filling an ever-expanding role in the DC universe, so no, won't happen.
Next up, I would put Tim Drake.
As would I. And that's only because they just did the fake-out death like a year and a half ago in Detective Comics.
They've already explored it. They're not going to plow over that ground again.
Not so soon, anyway. No.
No, not this soon. And nor should they.
No,
honestly.
Yeah.
I'm no Tim Drake fan, but, you know, no. Don't need to do that again. Then we get into the interesting ones here. The ones that are real contenders. I would put – and I know you're going to have this guy a little bit higher, I think, Nick. I would put at number three, Booster Gold.
I would – okay. Go ahead.
And here's my reasoning. I think that Booster is going to play a major factor moving forward in the coming – and I know that there's an out for this too, by the way. I know that this doesn't necessarily mean that this is a permanent death.
Right.
Or you know what I mean, permanent in comics is like a year. But I don't even think it's going to be that potentially if it is Booster. And I do think it's possible that it's Booster. But I put him third because I don't think he's overwhelmingly likely. I think that there's a good 50-50, put it for him, where I think he's got a lot of value and I think he's going to get a big push in the coming months. Anyway, that's just my take. And I think these other two characters are more expendable.
Okay. I would have Roy Harper at number three because while I think he's definitely on the board, I think he's by far the least impactful of any of these six characters that could die, and he has no real tie story-wise to Tom King. Tom King has not really used the character in the past, and I don't know that it would feel like a natural extension of any story that he's been telling.
Great point. Number two, I have Roy Harper, who you were just mentioning, and that's a great point that I hadn't considered about Tom King not really having a tie to Roy Harper. I think my thought on Roy and why I put him so high towards the top is he has essentially no purpose right now in the DCU. Nobody's using him for anything of value, it seems. He does not have any major storylines going on. He doesn't, you know, his value to Green Arrow has been greatly diminished by the likes of Amico Queen, by the likes of Black Canary, by the likes of the other characters that are close to Oliver. You know, if they ever bring back Connor Hawke,
right.
You know, I love Roy Harper, don't get me wrong, but I don't think he's been a particularly well-managed character.
Right.
So this would be a chance to revamp him eventually. What about your number two?
Kyle Rayner.
Who I know is your actual hope.
Yeah, I genuinely hope they kill him off because I you know he's grown on me in recent years, but he is easily my least favorite Earth Lantern, and
same.
I would argue there are too many freaking Earth Lanterns at this point. You need to drop one, but had to tie in to the Tom King story Omega Men, so it could feel like a natural extension for the Tom King version of that character, and because of the Tom King tie, I would put him I'd put him number two.
Very good. And I would actually put him at number one on the most likely to die list. For the same reasons you mentioned, there are a lot of Earth Green Lanterns right now. He would seem to be – he and Simon Baz would be the two most expendable, I think, of the Earth Green Lanterns. And I feel like Simon serves a greater purpose than Kyle in terms of adding diversity to the lineup. In a more tangible and clear way than Kyle, who I think has Latino origins but is very rarely drawn that way
or has it really referenced as part of his personality.
Part of his personality. And again, like Nick, Kyle has really grown on me in recent years. I was no fan of his for many, many years, but I like him as part of the ensemble. I'm glad that he is the Green Lantern again and no longer the White Lantern. and which I think was a concept that got explored too much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think he has some value, but he's also expendable. He also would have a huge impact across the DCU because he has strong relationships with Wally West, who is going to be a big part of this story, by the way. Kyle and Wally had a great friendship throughout the Justice League run in the 90s and early 2000s. He has a great tie to the Green Lantern Corps, relationships with characters like Sora Nicknatu and Jade, assuming that Jade is brought back into continuity, which I think she will be after Doomsday Clock. So there's just a lot of ties there for Kyle that I think would be interesting to explore.
Yeah. My number one is Booster Gold for a variety of reasons. One, he has just gone through a very traumatic experience in the pages of the Batman story, The Gift, which was written by Tom King, and it could feel like something that is natural that has been naturally built to and an extension of a more recent Tom King work than even Omega Men, like I referenced for the Kyle Rayner selection. And also, any death in comics, we know, is not going to stick. And Booster Gold, more so than any other character, has the built-in magic reset button of time travel to undo it when the time
right.
comes, making it the easiest death to it pull off even, and undo from a storytelling standpoint.
It may not even last the duration of a story arc.
May not.
Although I will say this, Nick, it does say in the – I've said I will say this about 400 times now. In this Newsarama article, it says – Booster Gold and Harley Quinn have long been identified as suspects in the murders, so they can likely safely be eliminated. What do you make of that?
I don't think that DC is going to publish a story in their own in-house magazine eliminating
right.
two of the characters when they just told you that one of the six is going to die. I mean, it's a comic company that is going to give misdirection on stories whenever possible. I mean – you know, see the solicits for Batman 50 as an example of that.
Mm. Ouch!
I don't believe anything they say. I'm sorry. They're janky promoters to reference a little seen and little appreciated Mike Epps movie.
Except unless they'd like to pay us as sponsors on our show, in which case we'll be glad to tell the people that they can believe every and anything that DC Comics tells them.
Indeed.
You know who else you can believe everything they say, Nick?
Who's that?
The makers of Blue Chew.
And when they say that it's going to get your gimmick rocking, trust me, folks, it's going to get your gimmick rocking.
And hey, when the gimmick is a rocking, she will come a knocking.
Indeed.
Blue Chew.
BlueChew.com. Use the promo code HTF69.
That's right. Amen, Stevie. That's right. Well, speaking of Sugar the Mockies, let's move over to another DC Comics story this week, and that is the formal announcement of a year-long 80th anniversary Batman celebration in 2019. It will include the release of Detective Comics number 1000. Of course, Batman debuted March 30th, 1939 in Detective Comics 27. Peter Tomasi and Doug Monke are taking over Detective in December to build towards this issue. Tom King's run will still be going on. We don't know any details of this, but there's going to be a bunch of artists involved in number 1000, and it's a year-long celebration, so you can bet your bottom dollar there's going to be a massive Batman crossover in which he will appear in everyone's book under the sun, to which some might say, Nick, how is that different from any other year?
The difference is I think you're going to have high-quality creative teams with both Tom King and Pete Tomasi leading the way, and a very high level of hype from DC Comics behind it rather than your average run-of-the-mill Batman crossover. It is the 80th anniversary. It is the 1,000th issue of Detective mm-hmm. Comics. I'm fairly sure there will be something of import, you know, that happens rather than something like, you know, Night of the Monster Men, which was the last crossover I can remember that was not really important at all. So I think they will put a bit more effort into this Batman crossover than your average one.
But, yeah, certainly the point stands taken that DC has never had any shortage of celebrating of Batman. So, this is certainly a great occasion. Detective 1000 is a landmark issue. It's going to be interesting to watch. I hope that it gives us something good. And I hope for – I just know what's going to happen, Nick. I just know it. I know what this is going to be. I know we're going to get another massive crossover, and I know that Dick Grayson is going to get pummeled in the process.
You better be more concerned than that. Jeff Johns is no longer around in a leadership role to protect your boy. So Danny D is sharpening the knives as we speak, I think.
Speaking of dysentery, Danny D. Let's get away from that, and let's get to a title that used to mean as much to me as Batman does. And that is Uncanny X-Men. We announced a couple episodes back with Ben Morse that Uncanny X-Men will be returning. Well, we've gotten a couple of details about that. First of all, we got the cover of issue number one, which seems to reveal the core team of Uncanny X-Men. At least that's the theory here. Including, now here's the characters that are listed here. Cannonball, Jubilee, Beast, Iceman, X-23, Storm, Jean Grey, Nightcrawler, Bishop, and a Psylocke that appears to be in her original British body rather than the Asian body that she inhabited in the early 90s. Long story there, folks. We'll talk about it perhaps on a show that we're planning for our PTBN comics future. That notwithstanding, this cover shows a couple of interesting changes to the X-Men from what we're used to. Bishop's a good guy again. Maybe that's been happening in the comics already. I don't know. Nightcrawler has a beard for the first time I've ever seen. Jean is in a very 90s-inspired outfit, which I think we've seen recently. Jubilee is in her 90s outfit. Iceman's got the spikes going on. Of course, we mentioned Psylocke. And the most interesting thing here is that Beast is drawn here to look like a blue version of either Swamp Thing or perhaps Etrigan the Demon.
You are highly critical of virtually every Beast redesign
yes.
that I have ever
Well, here's
seen.
The problem. Here's the problem. Pick a freaking design and go with it. That's my issue. It's like – and I haven't read the comics in recent years. I don't know if they would explain it the same way, but though I never liked Grant Morrison's secondary or tertiary mutation explanation for why Beast suddenly started looking like a cat. I hated that. I hated it primarily because I thought Beast's ape-like look was better than everyone that's come since. And I certainly don't understand why he now looks like some sort of, you know, half-dead creature from the Black Lagoon. So yes, I'm very critical of Beast redesigns because I'm pretty married to the one that I grew up with, I guess you would say, Nick. And that's the case with a lot of these X-Men designs. What do you think? Do you think this is a good design for Beast?
It's fine. I don't really – like, you know, X-Men don't, rise these deep, passionate feelings in me that they do in you because I never really had an attachment to them. Like, it's my – one of my biggest comics blind spots. So, like, I think it's cool that – it seems for the fifth time in the last 5 years that Marvel is trying to get its X-Men house in order, and we'll see how successful it is. So, I mean, like, I don't know. I'm this is one of those things that just doesn't do anything for me. But I understand why it does something for other people, and I genuinely hope that you guys are satisfied by it. And I say you guys as if you're actually going to read it when we know you're not. So,
well, you're the blind spot for me would be Avengers, and particularly Avengers leading up to Brian Michael Bendis's Avengers Disassembled back in the mid-2000s.
Well done, sir. Well, now, that actually – that's that's better than your typical nevertheless. I like that. I'm going to give you a little clap on that one.
Now Marvel is attempting seemingly to replicate the disassembling of the Avengers by – disassembling the X-Men. As it says, Uncanny X-Men number one will lead to a 10-part weekly storyline titled X-Men Disassembled from writers Ed Brisson, Kelly Thompson, and Matthew Rosenberg, along with artists Mahmoud Azrar, R.B. Silva, Yildiré Sinar, and cover artist Lainel Francis Yu. The announcement came with promotional art by David Marquez and Rachel Rosenberg, showing virtually all the X-Men with a big X through them. It says, no one survives the experience. So, absent in the image are the five original teen X-Men who will be resolved in the extermination story, and the adult Cyclops, who is still Deed at this point. I don't know what any of this means, Nick, to be honest with you. I'm tentative on it because they've tricked me with X-Men stories too many times at this point. But if I hear good things about it from our good buddy Ben Morris and Tim Capel and others, perhaps I will visit it on Marvel Unlimited when the time comes. But for now, not really. You know, I can say I'm not feeling it. It might be good. I just don't know much about it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the if they're using the spirit behind the original Brian Michael Bendis Avengers Disassembled, which was essentially to burn the house down so that you could rebuild it from the foundation, as someone who's never, you know, again, doesn't have a lot of X-Men knowledge and doesn't know the level of frustration, but just kind of hearing the feelings that have been out there in the ether for the last few years, that seems like a good idea. It seems like an idea to, you know, do a hard reset for the X-Men, for the lineup, and try to build a new foundation for the franchise going forward. So we'll see if it works out.
Well, perhaps instead, Nick, they could John burn the house down.
Oh.
How you like that for a transition? So the legendary writer and artist, John Byrne, who we have talked about on this show, Nick, not in the too distant past, because we reviewed his Superman the Man of Steel, if you recall, the miniseries from the 80s, and we had very high praise for it, talked about how well it holds up. Well, John Byrne has very much faded from the public eye in the last couple decades and is mainly seen being bitter online about things a lot of times anyway. And so you might think, hey, why are we talking about John Byrne? Well, as it turns out, there is a chance – against all odds, that John Byrne could be working with Marvel Comics again in the near future. They, of course, had a bitter and acrimonious breakup 18 years ago in 2000 when Marvel canceled his ongoing X-Men series at that time with very little notice, X-Men The Hidden Years. And Byrne held a grudge about that for a long time. Well, apparently, according to him at a fan expo in Boston, he revealed that, well, of course, many people know he's been doing a self-published continuation of his Uncanny X-Men run called X-Men Elsewhen, just him drawing his own pages and lettering and all that stuff, doing it all on his own just for fun. And apparently it caught the eye of Marvel's editor-in-chief, C.B. Sobolsky, which is still an amazing name. C.B. Sobolsky sent Byrne an email saying, love it, let's talk about this. And Byrne said it was very unexpected. He was just doing this as a fun thing and still is a fun thing as far as he's concerned. But it's the first time he's had contact with Marvel in ages. And he certainly appears to be entertaining the possibilities of going back there. This would be a very shocking turn of events. And Sobolsky has spoken highly of Byrne in the past. I think it would be kind of interesting. You know, Tim and I have talked before about how, you know, Claremont and Byrne, their attempts to return to X-Men have not been amazing. So you may not be able to recapture the lightning in a bottle. Probably almost assuredly won't,
you know,
at this point. But it's still kind of nice to see an old creator getting a chance to maybe, you know, do some things again.
Well, and you know, he's an older fellow, so if he does come back, I don't know that he can handle a series on his own. So may I propose a God, if Marvel could pull from their current crop of creators to give him a collaborator, if you will, a partner in crime.
I like it.
I mean, who wouldn't want to read a John Byrne, Mark Wade collaboration on the X-Men?
I think that's perfect. I thought that was where you might be going, Nick. And we're going to be the first to advocate for this right now. I think we need to start the hashtag Burn Wade X-Men and make this trend worldwide and get this to happen. Just think if we could bridge and bring together these two titans of comics. I mean, just think about the impact we would have had on the comic book industry, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a very interesting set of scenarios. And if nothing else, the comic dirt sheets would be on fire.
Oh, Rich Johnston. Rich Johnston would be in heaven. Absolutely.
Oh, God, the Jude Terror pieces that would come out of it.
Jude Terror. What a ridiculous thing. Jude Terror. Well, you have to wonder, though, that if Byrne and Wade worked together, Nick, do you think that their conflicts would resemble the conflict between Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke in the movie Training Day?
I don't know.
Well, I wonder that. And I also wonder how the director of Training Day, one Antoine Fuqua, would do directing a superhero movie. But further than that, Nick, how would he do directing a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie? Training Day director Antoine Fuqua is in talks right now to work with Marvel Studios to direct a film in the MCU. He recently revealed he's had meetings with President Kevin Feige of Marvel Studios about directing a Marvel film, but he said that he does have questions about a director's role in Marvel's blockbusters. I'm going to see if I can... Nope, of course not. They just linked to a video. So that's all we got, folks. We don't have anything to follow that up with. If you want to, just YouTube Antoine Fuqua Marvel, and hopefully it'll pull the video, and you, like us, can then find out exactly what he had to say about that. But I think this would be awesome. Antoine Fuqua is actually, you know, listen, no one's going to confuse most of his movies with The Godfather.
No.
But I think he's a damn good director. You know, I enjoy his movies. He's one of the great action directors of the modern era, I think, especially in America.
And it's one of those things where it makes me wish that, like, they weren't so opposed to the idea of crossing over the MCU and the Netflix characters. Because, like, Antoine Fuqua doing, you know, Iron Fist or Daredevil or something, like, something in that vein sounds freaking awesome. Like,
absolutely.
You know, not to say he couldn't do other things. I'm not trying to pigeonhole him strictly into that street-level hero thing. But, like, that sounds like a perfect match of concept and director. Whereas, you know, I don't really know. I'm struggling to think of a property off the top of my head that we think is in the works for Phase 4 or whatever that he would be a good fit for. You know, unless it's just something way out of left that we're not considering, like Moon Knight or something like that.
I think he would do a great job on a Captain America movie or a Winter Soldier movie if they did that.
Yeah, true. Especially or a Falcon movie if Falcon gets a standalone at this point.
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at his filmography. I mean, The Replacement Killer is awesome. Training Day, awesome. Tears of the Sun, really good. The Equalizer, really, really good. The Magnificent Seven, tons of fun. I mean, I love his feel, especially after seeing The Magnificent Seven. I think he could pull off a team movie really well if he was asked to do that. So I think that would be a great choice. I hope it happens. I think it would be cool. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, I do too.
What I don't think is going to be cool is Silver and Black. And apparently neither does the studio, because Silver and Black is not going to happen. This, of course, was the Sony movie that was going to team up Silver Sable and Black Cat. So instead of that, we're apparently going to get standalone movies separately for the Black Cat and Silver Sable. Black Cat will be the first one to go into production, presumably because she's the character that most people have actually heard of the two. And they say they're being faithful to comics, which is going to be very difficult without Spider-Man involved at all, as Black Cat is primarily defined by her relationship with Spider-Man, sadly enough, and also by the fact that she's a pretty blatant ripoff of Catwoman. So... this is the story here. It says director Gina Prince-Blythewood is unlikely to remain on board to direct either of these movies. Nick, I know you're just worked up about this Sony universe that includes Morbius, Kraven the Hunter, Silk, and Nightwatch, possibly Jackpot. I mean, I know you're really rip-roaring to go on this, but what are your thoughts on a Black Cat movie and a Silver Sable movie?
I'll believe they're actually going to happen when I see them.
Do you want them to happen, Nick?
Not really.
Can I just say what I said to you off the air when this story first broke last week?
Sure.
What if you'd said no? That would have been funny. Anyway, Black Cat movie does really very little for me outside of obvious adolescent boy-related reasons. Silver Sable, I think there's a good movie in there, or at least an intriguing movie, because I don't know much about Silver Sable. I know that it has to do with being an international mercenary that runs a mercenary organization. I think that there's something interesting in there, in a woman-led international espionage movie with somebody that's a mercenary for hire and a badass in the vein of, you know, maybe like a serious Deadpool, or in the vein of a Deathstroke or someone like that. I think you can get a pretty compelling movie out of that, personally. I think it would be harder to get a good Black Cat movie unless you just blatantly ape Selena Kyle, and I wouldn't appreciate that very much, given that DC can't seemingly do anything right with their movies. So, yeah, and Sony's track record not very strong at this point, so we'll see. Unlikely to happen, but supposedly they're planning on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know how back, you know, last year or not even last year, God, when we first started doing the podcast, and it felt like for months we were covering the build up to Justice League and talking about all these DCU plans, and I kept saying we are one Justice League bomb away from this all going straight to hell. We are one Venom bomb away from all this stuff going straight to hell, in my opinion.
I don't want this to happen. I will go see it on opening weekend and hope that it's good, but my official prediction is that Venom will bomb.
I guess
it will have a strong opening weekend.
Right.
And then it will crater, is my prediction.
Here's the thing, is like, I think the term bomb has kind of been redefined in the modern context, you know? Like, remember when the disappointment was that BVS didn't make $1 billion and that it was considered a disappointment? I think Venom will wind up be considered a moderately successful action movie had it been released a decade ago. I think in the current climate, it will make its money, it will make a small profit, and it will be considered a bomb even though it made money for Sony, is my opinion.
Fair. I'm not suggesting it's going to lose money. I think that it will have a hard time making any kind of a profit for the studio,
right,
of a significant manner. And then to close things out this week, we've got a little bit of story out of the DC Universe original series that they're doing here. Doom Patrol. The lead character in this is going to be Vic Stone, a.k.a. Cyborg, or at least one of the main characters in this. And they finally cast Cyborg in the form of the first Purge actor, Joyvin Wade. He will be playing Cyborg, who is described as charming and sarcastic, may be connected to every computer in the world, but he struggles to maintain the connections that make him human. Desperate to gain acceptance from the outside world, Vic harnesses the curse of his cybernetic body and uses his powers as the ultimate hero for the digital age. Now, what I find interesting here is I'm looking at this actor, Joyvin Wade, and he looks – I don't know how old he really is. He looks very young. He looks much younger than Ray Fisher looks to me. Would you agree with that, Nick?
I would.
And I think that's interesting, and while I'm not ever going to knock Ray Fisher, I thought he was – one of the most interesting parts of Justice League and did a good job. But I think this is definitely an indication perhaps that they're aiming younger with the character of Cyborg and portraying him in a less a more Teen Titans inspired manner than what we've gotten on the big screen.
Because you have to imagine that, I mean, based on what we've seen out of Titans so far, you know, that one trailer that looks ridiculous, but in a bad way. I think Doom Patrol is going to lean more to the weirdness to kind of help distinguish itself from Titans, you know. And I think having a lighter version of Cyborg probably fits into that somewhat. So we will see.
I hope you're right.
I've actually got Greg a surprise addition to the rundown that literally just broke about 15 minutes ago. If you'd care to hear it.
No, I wouldn't.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I would.
Variety is reporting, and God help us, we were not going to cover this story on the rundown this week. We had said no, and then this literally broke like 15 minutes ago. Variety is reporting that Disney president or Disney studio chairman Alan Horn met with James Gunn, and the decision has been made by Disney and Marvel to stand by their removal of James Gunn from the project, but that his script will be used for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. However, whoever the new director is will be given an opportunity to take a polish on that script if they so choose.
Oof. Interesting. Well, that's kind of what I thought would happen, Nick. I did not think he would be reinstated. Still a little disappointed in that, honestly. To be completely honest, I was hoping he would come back because I think it would be for the betterment of the movie. But there's lots of factors at play here. Very complicated and convoluted situation.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this affects particularly Dave Bautista. So we'll see, I guess.
And you wonder if that could create a domino effect that could eventually bleed into the Wrestling Minute. But that brings us to the end of the rundown and the beginning of what I am now renaming the Wrestling Undetermined Amount of Time.
That is fairly brief.
That is fairly brief.
Yes, it's not a wrestling podcast at this point.
Exactly. So over the weekend, I spent a great deal of time, more time than I would care to admit, catching up on the G1 Climax tournament, which concluded over the weekend. I caught up on all the matches, the big matches I had missed in the prior week, and watched almost all of the G1 singles matches over the weekend, of course concluding with a spectacular final match between I don't want to spoil it for those who – or maybe I don't know. What should we do, Nick?
We'll avoid spoilers for this weekend.
No spoilers, but the final match was incredible. Mm-hmm. Highly recommend it. Emotional, everything in between. Just an amazing tournament, Nick. And I have to say, this was my – again, another have to say. I'm going to have to break myself of saying I have to say. I must – because it's very close to I must say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't want to turn into that guy. So this was my first G1 tournament, watching it from beginning to end. I've seen matches on Access TV before, but I only got Access TV this year full time.
Mm-hmm.
This was my first time seeing the tournament as it's going on, and it definitely won't be my last. It was an incredible experience. I know maybe there's a tendency to get jaded on stuff when you watch it every year. For somebody that's a newcomer, it was mind-blowingly amazing. Just great main event after great main event, all kinds of awesome undercard matches, everybody out there trying to steal the show, wins and losses mattering throughout the entire tournament to the point where the audience, both at home and watching at home and also in the arena, is living and dying on every kick out, every near fall. It really incredible tournament, Nick, that reminded me of how simple wrestling can be and how great it can be in that simplicity.
Right on. Yeah, it was a great tournament. I love the concept, and I totally get the hype now. So,
yep.
There you are.
And other than that, other things going on in wrestling, the build to SummerSlam is going on. We have SummerSlam this Sunday. Monday Night Raw was a show that happened. SmackDown, I have not watched all of yet, but I liked what I saw of SmackDown, and appears to have been another solid show from the Blue Brand. Any predictions for this Sunday night, Nick?
Roman Reigns does not leave the building as the Universal Champion, one way or the other.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting. I think he does leave as the Universal Champion, but I think it's not a sure thing. It's far from a sure thing. Every time I thought it was a sure thing, I have been wrong. So it's a very shaky prediction on my part. I also predict that Carmella will not leave as the SmackDown Women's Champion. However, Alexa Bliss will leave as the Raw Women's Champion.
Fair enough. And that brings a close to the wrestling 5 minutes.
Absolutely. And with all that being said, Nick, what do we have coming the people's way?
I would argue that's a better question for you. What do we have coming the people's way next week?
Well, the endeavor will be made to produce a Long Book Hunters episode.
May I offer you what has been suggested by certain other individuals in place of that Long Book Hunt?
Yes.
Certain individuals have requested that HTF air a backdoor pilot for another comic podcast that was pitched to you not long ago. And the argument is, because you won't have to do the Long Book, you'll be more willing to do it.
We'll have to discuss this during a certain time-honored tradition, which we will discuss off the air. But I will endeavor to do the Long Book. And I am, by the way, I've already agreed to do the pilot of this of said episode.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a question of whether that's going to happen at some point. But I would like to read this story. We're trying to do. Let's reveal a little bit of the sausage making here, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to do a Long Book Hunt on the Kurt Busiek and George Perez Avengers run of the late 90s. And yet the trade collection, instead of being a typical trade, from what we can find online anyway, the trade collection, instead of collecting your typical five or six issue story arc, collects apparently the first 11 issues. And for a slow reader such as myself, it is extremely intimidating to try to read the – and these are not – and I can say I've started the first issue, and it is not a what I would consider to be a terribly fast read, as I am trying to get caught up on who the hell all these people are and what's going on and all this other stuff. So and it's like 34 pages too. So I'm trying to get through that, and I feel like maybe once I get to the first issue, it'll read a lot faster after that, and I'll be able to get through it. If not, then yes, we may have to do this backup episode and push the Long Book to next month or the month after.
Probably push it a considerable amount, since we already have a Long Book locked in with a special guest for the month of September, and of course October marks the return of Walking Dead month. So
true. Well, anything else you want to add for the listening public there, Nick, before we bid them adieu?
Fuck Riverdale. And fuck the Miami Marlins and Jose Urania.
Jose Uranus?
Good Urania.
Lord.
Fuck him.
Well, I don't know this man, but... you know what? If Nick says fuck him, there's one thing I've learned. It's that it takes a lot for Nick to have an issue with someone.
That's right. I'm generally a personable, easygoing, easy to get along with guy. So
that's right.
If I have a problem, you know there's something wrong.
You really help the content integration here at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop. You help us take a synergistic approach to building the
infrastructure.
They're
giving you the go-home cue, so...
you know, you really help us... oh, folks, time wait a minute. What's this? We're desperately out of time. Folks, ladies, stay tuned for Robin Hood.
Car-traveling bad boys.
You vicious little son of a bitch.
We're indivisible. They're microwavable.
Oh, Mr. Eddie!
Ooh, hot traveling fanboy,
are you gonna give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Listen up, slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question.
Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
I believe it was quite sudden, and thank
you. Hard traveling fanboys.
Are traveling fanboys.